Hello, and welcome to the first ever short story podcast. To start with, give you a bit of an introduction into what this is and why I'm doing it. Basically, I enjoy writing. Unfortunately, or fortunately, I also enjoy procreating. So, having two small children leaves me not very much time for actually writing. So when I do write, pretty much the only thing I can manage is a short story here or there. And it's all very enjoyable writing, obviously, but on the other hand, it's slightly dispiriting if you're not actually doing anything with that. I mean, I send it to a few friends, but that's generally the limit of it. So what I thought I would try and do is I would try and start a podcast of it, seeing as podcasting is now easy and hip. Yeah. So to get us started, I have a short story which I wrote a very long time ago, but I thought it would be a nice, gentle introduction. And so I'm going to read that. I warn you now, I'm going to attempt an American accent in it. But after that, I will then say how you can get in contact if you want to do anything, if you have a short story of a burning desire to get it out there into the world. So, here we go. This story is What He Saw, and it is an Inspector Marks mystery. The butler glared. He was not used to receiving visitors at this hour, nor in this state. The master will see you now. The words seemed like a personal defeat. His own feelings had no influence on events in the house. He was a cog. Thank you, I know the way. The butler, smarting at the second nasty reminder, went to his room to get drunk. The process began with a glass of port. At this stage, he could still say that it was a single drink, to unwind after work. The single drink could not quell the anger, so a second followed. As the night wore on, the butler found himself unable to release himself from the euphoric oblivion of drunkenness, the angry impotence of his position acting as an anchor around his neck. Yet the alcohol was not without effect, serving to destroy the rationality and the reason, the concern for the future that would usually keep his actions in check. Suffice to say, the butler was no longer civil. Unable, unwilling to control his urges, the butler strode into the hall. Once he was out of the room, the self-imposed cage he had been concentrating all his mental energy on escaping from, butler achieved the joy he had been seeking all night, the joy of freedom. He was now presented with a vast array of possibilities. No longer restrained by any code of conduct, and in a house built on the principle of pleasure satisfied, the butler became giddy. The only blackness in his mind now was regret that he had not done this sooner. The only emotion restraining him was indecision. Where to go first? He stumbled towards the lounge, noisily opening the door. The butler did it. The policeman was pleased with his wit, even though Inspector Marks had heard the same joke 5 times already this morning, as he suspected the policeman also had. Yes, well, that does appear to be the case. More than appeared to be the case, was the case, but the very cliché rattled his bones. He hadn't earned his reputation as the modernist detective with such decidedly Edwardian solutions. Marks vowed to discover the real murderer, and that the real murderer would astound the establishment. He decided to start his investigation with the innocent victim of the whole affair. So, Mr. Butler, what have you to say to yourself? Marks was lounging on the divan, a cigarette between his teeth. He had no idea how to smoke, but thought witnesses were more forthcoming when there was something else to concentrate on. He even attempted to blow some smoke rings, which had the desired effect of making the butler feel confused and unsettled. The butler muttered something and tried to look out the window, but there were no windows, so this unsettled him even more. "Is this really necessary?" asked Sergeant Mazzini. "I mean, it's not like you can tell us anything we don't know." "Ah, but what do we know?" said Marks, oblivious to the mumbling butler. "Well, we know how he did it, don't we? We know he got drunk and went and smashed Lord Walton's head in." "Incorrect. All we know is that he got drunk, then went into the room, where 12 seconds later he was discovered with a vase in his hand and a corpse at his feet." "But there was no one else in there. It had to be him." "Incorrect again. While it was undoubtedly his arm that brought the vase down on the young squire's head, with enough force to crack it open and end his life, we do not know who actually committed the crime." I'm hungry. The butler stared aggressively at Marks. Of course you are, dear sir. Mazzini, make this man some sausages. As the two men left, Marks sank further into the cushions. This was tricky. He could feel the limitations of his own intelligence. The walls of reason and rationality that restrained him disabled him from making the leaps of intuition needed. He was sure that the visitor who had arrived late at night, left minutes before the crime, was integral to the affair. Staff had heard him entering and leave. No one had seen his face or heard his voice but the master and his butler, and one was too dead and the other too boring to question. He decided it was time to invoke his power of free-form bebop thinking. 2 hours later, he sat with Mazzini in the Foreign Coconut, a small underground jazz bar. On stage was a small mustachioed man wearing a trilby and playing the piano, while a middle-aged woman in a green dress hummed and squeaked. Mazzini clicked his fingers and drank rum, while Mark stared at the floorboard. "It's all around us, you see," he whispered. "What is?" Mazzini was smiling, enjoying himself. "Everything. Everything is around us, which means that somewhere is what we're looking for." He shut his eyes and concentrated on his thoughts, but kept finding himself paying more attention to the music being played. His mind drifted and swam in the uplifting and surprising noise. Each piece began as a familiar standard before the ingenuity and rapport of the performers twisted and built it into something new and revolutionary. It all seemed to strike a chord in him. "That's it!" Marks exclaimed, standing up. "What?" "We need clues!" They got a taxi back to the crime scene and Marks put his glasses on. "Right, Mazzini, let's look around. See if there's anything that might shed some light on this affair." "All right, but I don't think we'll find anything new." "It's not what we find, it's how we find it." Mazzini sighed as Marks scuttled off. He found the inspector in the garden admiring a freshly dug hole. "Well, I found some cigarette ends that seem to be quite an odd brand. No one in the house smokes them. And there was this business card left in the lounge. No name on it. Just a large letter T." Marks waved his hands dismissively. "What do I care about cigarettes or business cards? Look at this!" He gestured towards the hole. "Do you want me to ask the gardener about it?" "No, you ask the gardener and he won't know what you're talking about. You're too close to this thing. Take a step back. No, further. Further! There! What do you see?" It is, Mazzini! A giant footprint! The greatest clue of all! Now, what would have a foot this size?"
The only thing I've ever seen was a dinosaur footprint down at the Natural History Museum."
"Then to the Natural History Museum we will go." The professor's office was surprisingly smart. No piles of paper or obscure specimens in jars. Mazzini suspected he was an imposter, but kept quiet. He stood against the wall beside the door while Marks paced up and down asking questions and the professor played with a desk toy, a small wooden fox with adjustable limbs. "And you're sure, sir, that there's no possibility of a dinosaur being alive today?"
"No, as I say, dinosaurs have not walked this planet for millions of years. With today's cartographic techniques, we have mapped the world to such an extent that I can say, with certainty, there does not exist an area of land undiscovered that could hide a breeding stock of any species of dinosaur. Especially not one capable of leaving a footprint such as the one you've described."
"How about space dinosaurs?"
"Certainly not. What was this in relation to, anyway?"
"The murder down at Walton Manor."
"But the newspaper said the man was bludgeoned to death with a vase. No dinosaur would ever bludgeon a man. It's absurd."
"Of course!" The professor flinched at Mark's exclamation. "How could I be so stupid? Here we are at the Natural History Museum investigating a murder, when murder is the most unnatural event there is, a perversion of all society stands for."
Mazzini started.
"Well, what could have left that footprint then?"
"Well, if it wasn't natural, then Mason must have been some kind of mechanical creation. Like the good professor's fox, only taken to monstrous proportions."
"But who could have the technology to create a mechanical man of such dimensions?"
Marx grimaced.
"I can think of only one man."
The elevator door pinged open.
"Top floor, presidential suite,"
the bellboy smiled. He held his hand open, but Marx just grimaced again. The occupant, presumably alerted by front desk, was waiting to greet them.
"Good evening, Inspector."
"Good evening, Mr. Ford."
"Please call me Henry."
He ushered them into the suite. It was a modern room, which mainly seemed to consist of windows with works of art fighting it out with the doors to the bedroom and bathroom for the remaining space. However, this was a hotel favoured more by travelling businessmen than the idle rich, and so desks and other apparatus of business littered the place. Henry Ford took a seat behind the most imposing desk at the centre of the room, and gestured towards a group of armchairs.
"I must admit, Inspector, I'm at a loss to think what I might have done in the 2 weeks I've been visiting this lovely country that might warrant such a visit. But anything I can do to help..."
Mark glared at him. "Why did you visit Lord Walton last night?" Ford carried on smiling.
"I'm not sure I've met a Lord Walton. There was a Lord Humminburg, and a Lord Fancy, but I'm fairly sure there was no Lord Walton."
"So you didn't travel to his house last night in some kind of giant mechanical suit?"
"Why, sir," Ford could hardly conceal his smirk, "I don't know how you think we're doing technologically over in the States, but I think giant walking machines are still quite a way off."
"Well then," said Marks as he strode over to a large wardrobe, "how do you explain this?" He threw open the wardrobe to reveal a bright orange boiler suit splattered with oil stains.
"Why, it must belong to one of my..."
Without missing a beat, Ford had reached into a drawer and threw a small walnut-sized item onto the carpet. As Mazzini leapt up, thick black smoke filled the room. Mazzini threw a chair through the window to clear the smoke and ran to where Ford had been. He caught a glimpse of Mark's brogue disappearing through a passageway that had appeared behind a bookcase, but as he reached it, it slammed shut. He stood there, pounding and coughing away as the room slowly cleared of smoke, until the sound of screaming from outside caught his ears and he ran to the broken window. Once there, he was presented with a spectacle that he could hardly believe. Striding through the streets was a giant copper contraption. It was so large the tallest buildings only came up to its shoulder. Pocketing its skin like bristling hair, were valves and pipes bellowing out steam. As if to dispel any doubt of the inhumanity of Ford, he had fashioned his creation as a strange cross between monkey and man, its lips in a perpetual sneer. More spectacular than the behemoth, flailing wildly at fashionable boutiques, was the sight of two men grappling on its head. The size of the machine, however, gave the whole affair the air of a man with two squirrels resting on his head. Mazzini squinted, and could make out the shiny topper of Ford and the flamboyant overcoat of Marks. He held his breath as Ford toppled Marks with a sly kick, and stood there in bewildered impotence as the industrialist stood over his prey, ready to send him flying to his doom. He was just as powerless to present the huzzah that left his lips as he saw Marks dodge the blow, and in a fluid motion send a sharp kick into Ford's side. Ford readjusted his weight to try to prevent his fall, but it was to no avail as he slipped down the smooth surface of his devilish machine. He fell wildly at nothing as he fell screaming to the ground. By the time his screaming was punctuated by an abrupt crack, Marks had already leapt through the eye of the metal man-monkey, and under his control the creature sat gingerly to the ground, then remained motionless. The next day, at Marks's dinner of honour, Mazzini felt he had to have the answers, though he knew he would be mocked for his own ignorance.
"So, sir, how did Ford make the butler commit murder? Some kind of mechanical mind control, Ray, I'd wager."
"Your problem, Mazzini, is your overwhelming ignorance. You must look at these things so literally. But think of this. Man is a social animal. The presence of his soul allows the kind feelings and gentle actions towards his fellow citizens that allow society to function. So much so that it becomes like a living organism."
"Like Hobbes's Leviathan,"
Marx sighed. "Well, crushing monotony, the grey impersonality of today's culture, as created by that devil Ford's confounded production lines, is killing off our society's soul. In this climate of evil, it's of no surprise that horrendous acts such as our disgruntled butler's drunken violence occur. Though our gentleman's gentleman actually swung the vase that cracked the head, the anger was put in him by Ford's scheming ways. He is no more to blame for his actions than a schoolboy who burns down his school."
"Ah," said Mazzini.
The end. So, there we have it. Hope you enjoyed it. I have set up a page, or blog, as some people might call it, at shortstorypodcast.wordpress.com. And in the comments space there, if you have any feedback, it'd be really good to hear it. The other thing I was thinking is if anyone else would like to have their story read out, you could email me at shortstorypodcast@hotmail.co.uk, and I can see about getting that on the air. Obviously, we need to have no copyright on it and so forth. This is all getting started, so I'll put more information on the website. I'll try and get this on iTunes as well at some point. But anyway, until the next story, goodbye.